EFT Champaign 90.1 FM. This hour of programming is brought to you by Common Ground Food Co-op. Food that nourishes you and gives back to your community may be found at Common Ground Food Co-op located in Lincoln Square Mall. Your dollar stays local when you shop the co-op, cultivating community and local food since 1974. And now stay tuned for today's episode of Disability Beat. This is Disability Beat, a public affairs program for and about people with disabilities. It's about social justice, community supports, inclusion, accessibility, freedom, and choice. My name is Vicki Nicewander, and I'm the host of this program and also the parent of a fantastic young woman with a disability.
The views and opinions expressed here are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT, its board of directors, associate station manager, or Prairie Air Incorporated.
Stay tuned for an interview with Jessica Loving, author of Special Siblings, Growing Up with a Sibling Who Has Special Needs. But first, disability news for the week of December 23rd, 2019. The U.S. Department of Transportation is seeking public comment on a plan calling for an all-new single-aisle aircraft to feature accessible lavatories. Current rules only mandate accessible restrooms on planes with more than one aisle, but the federal agency said that single-aisle aircraft are increasingly being used on long-haul flights. The Transportation Department proposal released last week says, quote, "The inability to use the lavatory on long flights can present significant challenges to passengers with disabilities and poses a deterrent for some passengers with disabilities to travel by air," end quote. The agency is looking to amend its existing Air Carrier Access Act regulation. Under the plan, new single-aisle aircraft that seat 125 or more passengers must have lavatories with accessible toilet seats, assist handles, faucets, attendant call buttons, and door locks, among other features. Airlines would also be required to have an onboard wheelchair with improved safety and maneuverability that could provide entry into the aircraft lavatory. The proposed rule stipulates that flight attendants be trained to assist individuals with disabilities to get from their seat to the lavatory using the onboard wheelchair. What's more, information about the accessibility of an aircraft's lavatories would be available on airline websites, on the plane, and upon request so that travelers can plan accordingly, the Transportation Department said. Federal officials are not requesting any change to the physical size of lavatories on single-aisle aircraft, but they said that an advance notice of proposed rulemaking is expected in the near future to solicit feedback on the idea of mandating that lavatories on new single-aisle aircraft match the larger size found on planes with two aisles. The Transportation Department estimates that it would cost approximately $1,000 per lavatory to make the improvements that the agency is seeking. The current proposal will be up for public comment for 60 days. Diana Elliott, mother of a child with Down syndrome, stands accused of abandoning her nonverbal 14-year-old son at a hospital in Atlanta, Georgia, earlier this month. After her subsequent arrest, the mother told police she was, quote, overwhelmed caring for her son, along with her three other children, who are all minors. She was charged with federal child cruelty, and all of the children were taken into custody by the Georgia Division of Family and Children's Services. The case has drawn widespread attention and started a broader discussion about how families struggle to get by when they have a child who has special needs, while they also may be enduring economic troubles. She was arrested by police at a hotel where they said she was living with her children. In an interview, DFCS Director Tom Rawlings said he couldn't legally disclose whether the family had a history with the agency, but he said he hopes the case can serve as a reminder that struggling families have access to services that may keep them from becoming desperate. Said Rawlings, quote, "It really can push these families to the breaking point. We want to encourage these folks to ask for help. There are mental health services, homelessness services, children's medical services," end quote. Elliot was charged with first-degree child cruelty, a crime that carries a sentence of between 5 and 20 years in prison. The judge at the first court appearance hearing granted her a $10,000 signature bond, allowing her to leave jail. Many nuances of the family's life in the case haven't yet come into full view, but onlookers so far seem to largely be sympathetic to Elliot's plight. Cheryl Arno, executive director of Down Syndrome Association of Atlanta, was among the people at the court hearing. When Arno does not know the family's full story, she said having a child with Down syndrome can be extraordinarily trying. She said, quote, "My assumption is that Diana was overwhelmed and felt like there was no one there to support her," end quote. Elliot is expected to return to court on December 26th to face her charge. And what will happen with Elliot's family is still unclear. And finally, 'tis the season of peace, joy, and love, but if you're a kid who struggles with a mental illness such as depression, anxiety, or other mental health concern, you may not feel like spreading the good cheer. Imagine being a child with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder and having the task of sitting through the long church service or holiday performance, all while hoping that you don't get in trouble. Frequently for kids, home for the holidays means no routine, irregular sleep schedules, lots of sweets, crowded places, and being around rarely seen relatives. We're continually being reminded that everything should be merry and bright because it's the most wonderful time of the year, but that's not necessarily the reality for many. It's a disheartening fact that for far too many of the nation's youth who struggle with one or more mental illnesses, according to a study published in the Journal of Pediatrics in March, about 1.9 million kids aged 3 to 17 years old have been diagnosed with depression, and 4.4 million have been diagnosed with an anxiety disorder. According to a 2018 study in the Journal of Clinical Child and Adolescent Psychology, nearly 6.1 million kids aged 2 to 17 have been diagnosed with ADHD. Research published in the Journal of Abnormal Psychology finds that within the past decade, the number of youth with mental health disorders has more than doubled. According to Rochelle Lohman, professional counselor and author, there are a few things parents can do to help their child survive the holiday season. First, find the calm in the storm. As creatures of habit, we crave order. When things get chaotic, as often happens during the holiday season, we get stressed and so do our kids. Be mindful of how you're feeling and imagine that your child may be experiencing what you are feeling tenfold. So if you're headed to your relative's house for that dreaded holiday gathering, you most likely aren't the only one feeling that way. Be open and honest and share your feelings with your teen. You can even discuss how long you're planning on staying and come up with safe spaces to allow your teen a moment to retreat. Who knows, you may even want to join them in their escape. Second, maintain a healthy sleep schedule. With many schools being on winter break, it's easy to stay up late and sleep away the day. This disruption in the sleep cycle can affect a teen's mental health. Also be wary of late night electronic use as it can wreak havoc on a sleep schedule as well. And finally, Lohman recommends discouraging isolation but letting kids limit their social activities. Sometimes all the holiday excitement and festivities can be overwhelming and too much can be counterproductive and even make your teen feel worse. Doing things in moderation can make the holiday season more enjoyable. You should also let your teen know that some holiday activities are optional. According to a recent survey from Total Brain, a mental health and fitness organization, more than one-third of adults in the U.S. would happily skip the stressful holiday season. If it's affecting that many adults, think about how it impacts youth who struggle with mental illness. And that's the news for this week. Thank you. And you are tuned to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. This is Disability Beat. I'm Vicki Nicewander, and I'm joined today on the phone by Jessica Loving, who is the author of a children's book called Special Siblings, Growing Up with a Sibling Who Has Special Needs. Welcome to the program, Jessica.
Hi, thanks so much for having me on.
So, this is quite you've been of a sibling for your whole life, right? Your brother is younger than you. And so your book has just been published recently?
Yes. So I actually wrote it when I was in high school, but it's just been published, and now is now available on Amazon for the public to buy for the first time as of a few months ago.
So, it's available, and you sent me a copy of it, so I really appreciate that. Tell us a little bit about the inspiration behind the book. Why did you make the decision to write this way back when you were in high school, which is, what, about 10 years ago, maybe?
I think a little more than that. Let's say more like 15 years ago, something around there.
Time flies.
So I actually was approached by an organization in my suburb. I grew up in Highland Park right outside Chicago. And my brother received services at Jewish Child and Family Services. I think then it was called the Jewish Children's Bureau. And through him going there was someone who spoke with my mom. And I have always loved writing, and even in high school was working on a lot of short fiction and different types of writing for class and just for fun. And someone, I think, mentioned to my mom in passing, we get a lot of siblings coming in, too, who are dealing with their own issues. And sometimes that's, be it anxiety, depression, behavioral issues. We really don't have a lot of resources to share with them. I wonder if your daughter could write something about the sibling experience. And so my mom just, came home and mentioned it to me, and I thought, sure, sounds like fun. And so really I just kind of wrote this book about, it was really based on my experience with my brother, Billy, who's 6 years younger than me, and to sort of depict different situations that we might find ourselves in, which include both the fun things, like the games we would play together, tricks we would play on our parents, kind of that fun of having a close sibling relationship, which we definitely did and still do. And then some of the harder parts, like what happens when he does something that's embarrassing, or we were playing a game together and he didn't understand the rules and that was frustrating. I wrote my draft and then I shared it with the people at the Jewish Children's Bureau, and they also gave some feedback on what other issues kids were sharing with them. And so I added a couple of things in also to be more reflective of that experience. And it really started off with just, I got a really small grant when I was in high school to publish like 100 copies of the book and had them at the Jewish Children's Bureau as well as my brother's school and just passed them around locally. And really since then I just had like 3 copies left over sitting in my closet for all these years. And summer just sort of was curious. I've thought over the years, like from time to time, oh, I should really do something with that and maybe publish it, but I figured somebody else must have already done it. And I just went on Amazon and looked and really saw that there still are not a lot of books out there that are geared towards specifically helping young siblings.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the books that are there are really focused, like a lot of the books that do include siblings, I felt were really focused more on using the sibling as like a vehicle to introduce this is my sister with autism and she may struggle with this, but she's really good at this. And they were very focused on like the positive elements and sort of teaching about what autism is, which I think is wonderful and really important, but was really different than what this book had set out to do. Once I realized that actually publishing it, it's self-published, it was more doable than I thought it would be, and kind of just dove in and thought, well, okay, I want to share this with the world. I was able to get it published.
And, I shared before the program that my younger daughter, who is also a sibling of a person with a disability, her older sister, read it and had nothing to add. I think the thing that she really appreciated, it was exactly what you said, that it didn't just gloss over the difficult stuff that you go through as a sibling, that, you have to acknowledge that this stuff happens and that there are ways of thinking about it and dealing with it. So that we appreciated
that. Yeah, exactly.
So what are when you look back on your childhood with your brother, what are some of the things that happened to you that really stick out in your mind as important moments in your relationship and in your family history?
Well, we've always been really, really close. You know, I think because he's 6 years younger than me, he very much was, you know, even before we had the autism diagnosis, I was like the mini mom. I wanted to push him in the stroller and like play with him like he was a doll. And I think for a couple of years, sort of like in the early days, it was really natural for me to take on like a caregiving role. Like I wanted to babysit. I wanted to help with everything. And one of the things that I wanted to make sure were sort of included in the book and that I've been speaking about a lot when I am talking to families and other siblings is this idea of making sure that, like, kids don't get parentified or that you don't, like, internalize too much that it's your role to take care of your siblings. I think I did at a certain point around probably middle school or high school start really taking on a lot of my own worry about what would happen to my brother. Like, I guess one specific time I remember is he had to go. So the way that our suburb worked, there were a couple of different elementary schools, and then they would filter into one of two middle schools. And all of the kids at his elementary school were going to this one middle school, but there was no special ed program there. So he was going to have to go to the other one. And I remember my mom being really upset and worried because he wasn't going to know anybody at this school, as opposed to, you know, like he had been in school for 6 years with all these kids who got to know him. Like, oh, that's silly. And she didn't want him to have to develop all of these new relationships. Like, it's going to be stressful to transfer schools anyway, and now he's going to have to deal with all these new social changes. And I remember, like, really spending a lot of time around that transition period also just being very worried, and it was, like, consuming. Like, I was in all of the conversations. I wanted to know what was happening constantly. And I think there were a couple different times like that where it was just difficult to sit back and be like, you know what, my mom can handle this. Like, my parents have this under control. It's not up to me to fix this problem. So that was definitely one of the points. But then, you know, there were other things where, like, I would be jealous, like, that the rules weren't the same. Like, he always got to have the TV on, and he had a TV in his room, and I remember he could have it on constantly, whereas I would always get in trouble. Like, if I left the lights on in my bedroom, I remember my parents constantly being like, you know, do you work for the electric company? Do you pay the bill? You know, that kind of thing. Always getting on my case if I left the TV on, left a game on, left the lights on, whereas, like, he didn't have to worry about that, and it was okay for him, and I felt like that was very unfair. lots of little things like that that as I got older, of course, I understood. But even if you understand, I think, especially for younger kids, there's still sometimes that sting of like, hey, like, we should all have the same rules. No fair.
Now, I have to ask that at the time when this, when you were thinking, having this disagreement, maybe not even vocalizing this to your parents or your brother, but you were thinking about the idea of this not being fair. Did you ever say anything to your parents, and how did they receive that if you did?
Yeah, it's a good question. I don't really think I did. Like, I can't remember any time that I raised the issue. I think I probably more often just, like, choked it back and felt frustrated and then went about my day, because I think I did understand on some level why it was happening. Like, you know, being that I was older, I always, you know, I was aware when he got the autism diagnosis, I could tell, you know, I had some sense of what was happening. And I knew that the rules were different for us, and I think I didn't want to be a burden or, like, it was even, and I've spoken about this before too, that, like, there's the sense of conflicting emotions that I think is really common for siblings of someone with a disability, that you feel, like, guilty for having a feeling that you have. Like, I think, you know, I might feel jealous that these rules.
And then you feel bad because you feel jealous. Yeah. Yeah. I totally,
right, like,
totally
I
get that.
Feel jealous.
And I hear frequently from siblings, they say, well, you know, I don't want, like, as you said, I don't want to be a burden to my parents. They have enough on their plates already, and I don't want to be one more problem that they have to deal with.
Exactly. And I just recently learned, actually, I'm working on a podcast that's specifically focusing on like topics affecting siblings, and I interviewed a psychologist who's done research around sibling issues, and he said there is a statistical link between that kids who have a sibling with a disability are more statistically likely to have anxiety or depression, or there was this idea of, like, they're called internalized emotions, that they're less likely to have problems like skipping school or drug use or anything that's going to be an added burden to the family. It's like a very specific, like, problems that come from shoving your emotions inside and not asking for help because of this sense of not wanting to be an additional burden your parents are already facing so much.
Right. And I think that, you know, my feeling is just from hearing you that you were pretty open and honest with your parents growing up. And, you know, maybe internalize some things, but you were one who was going to be helpful and do what you could to make it better for your brother and for your family. What were the issues that were most problematic for you to deal with in that regard?
You mean like as I got older?
Yeah, as you got older, right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think especially like working on writing the book in high school was a good way of for myself what some of those issues were, like that I hadn't even realized I was going through. So being able to like validate some of those emotions just by the act of being asked to write about it was really helpful. But I think as I got older, the harder thing was really like figuring out boundaries and just navigating some of that guilt. I think there's a lot of guilt that happens. And I'm in a couple of like Facebook groups now for adult siblings, and I like everybody talks about it, that it's so hard, especially like in your 20s and 30s. Like when I went away to college, I felt really guilty for leaving my brother, and you know, phone conversations were not great for him, and we had a tough time staying in touch while I was gone. And then I also remember coming home on the holidays, I wouldn't have seen him for a while, and he'd have, you know, he'll have some new behavior. Like I remember I came home one time and he was wearing a cowboy hat and like wanted to, this is his thing, that he like wanted to wear a cowboy hat everywhere we went. He was speaking in a southern accent. That's like hilarious. And it was like kind of funny for a minute, you know, and then got a little old, especially when I was like, you know, 20 and home from college and trying to see my friends and like wanted to be cool or normal or whatever. And I'd be really embarrassed to go to the movies or something, and I would just constantly be telling him like, don't do that. Don't talk like that.
Yeah, you're. If you can move your closer to the phone, you're kind of breaking up bit there. So, thinking about, I mean, this is certainly written for siblings of children with disabilities to really understand what their role is and kind of have something to relate to as far as what their experience is. But if you were able to give advice to parents of younger children who are in this place, besides buying your book and giving that to their children, what are some of the things that you would ask parents to think about when they're raising children together, some, you know, maybe one with a disability and others that do not have disabilities?
Yeah, I think the number one thing is just making space for all of those emotions, and like some of the jealousy or the guilt that we talked about, I think is really common for even really young kids to feel, and they aren't always going to take the initiative to share it with parents. So I think for parents to really be proactive about saying to their kids, you know, asking, how did this make you feel? And especially after a tough situation, like maybe you're in public and your child with a disability has a meltdown and, you know, in the moment you're triaging and really can only take care of one kid at a time, then to later really make sure and go back to the other kid and the family and say, how does that make you feel? And you know, not obviously not to like push if they feel fine, they feel fine. But if I think to really make sure that there is that emphasis on like, if a kid says, oh, I'm fine or I'm okay, just to give at least one more, like, are you sure? Like, it's okay if you're not. Just let them know that, like, if they were mad or jealous or embarrassed, that those are all okay to talk about, and that there's no such thing as, like, a bad emotion, that we feel the way we feel, and that doesn't necessarily mean we're going to change anything in our situation, but it's normal to feel sad and guilty and embarrassed and jealous, and just making sure that those emotions get validated, I think, is huge and makes a big difference.
As a parent, I look back on our experience with three kids, and I think to myself sometimes that, you know, I probably did not give as much attention to the other two kids that didn't have disabilities as much as the one that did. And of course, I have guilt about that. But the kids really are very reassuring to me. So so I guess I can feel better about that. But I, you know, that's something that I think we don't think about often enough is, you know, paying attention and spending time and validating those feelings as well. So now that you're an adult, your brother is getting older as well and, you know, probably has some plans for the future. And that's something that we as, you know, adults have to think about. And particularly siblings have to think about, because honestly, as a sibling, you're probably going to spend more time, you know, the number of years that you spend caring for your brother, at least caring about your brother, is going to be probably the longest relationship that you have in your life. And so what are the things that are on your mind today about the future for Billy?
Yeah, and I think that's another big area where parents can be really, really helpful is I'm really fortunate that my mom has been very on top of future planning and has always included me in the process. So I know that she has the paperwork in order and the finances in order. I know what the plans are in terms of his future care. And she's been really honest and open with me about what my options are in terms of staying involved in his life. So right now he still lives with my mom and he's really happy there and that the arrangement works out really well. And we don't really know what the future will hold, but I think I've been able to feel a lot less anxiety knowing that there are plans in place so that if he were to go to a group home or if we were going to turn my mom's house into a group home, maybe where he would live with a couple of other people, that those are options, or, you know, maybe he'll come live with me someday. And that's something that I feel like I can have that conversation with my partner as the time comes and we can figure out what works for us as a family. And just to be able to know, though, that it's not like some mysterious thing that's going to get dumped on me in the future has been really great, because I know in some of the adult groups I'm in, there are people who come find this group when they're 45 and their parents are aging, and suddenly, out of nowhere, they just found out that, you know, they're the legal guardian for their sibling and they have no idea what to do. And it is really overwhelming. And, you know, I definitely know that I'm going to have to be more involved in the future and that there are going to be responsibilities that I'll have to take on. But knowing that it's been, like, so far really handled for me and that everything is in place so that when it is time for me to come in, I'll just be sort of like picking up the reins instead of starting from zero is really helpful.
So before we run out of time, Jessica, where can people get a copy of your book?
So the book is available on Amazon. You can just search for Special Siblings by Jessica Leving. And I also have a website. It's a little long. I don't know if there's somewhere to include it in the show notes. It's,
if you want to send it to me, I can post it on the Disability Beat Facebook page.
But go
ahead and give it to them because we have enough time. We've talked about it enough that maybe they've got a pen now. So go ahead and give them the website.
Perfect. So it's Make It Sing. It's MAKEIT-SING/Special Siblings Book. And you can find the book there as well as a link to the podcast. And we also have a Facebook group. Again, you could just search Facebook for Special Siblings Growing Up with a Sibling Who Has Special Needs. And the link to the Facebook group, or I'm sorry, the link to the website is also posted there, and all the updates will be there about the podcast.
Great. Thanks so much for joining me today. Jessica Leving, author of Special Siblings, Growing Up with a Sibling Who Has Special Needs. No, I'm staying.